Welcome to Chi Alpha at the University of Virginia. This podcast is a collection of messages designed to help you grow in our three anchors of real devotional life, real community, and real responsibility.
We hope that you enjoy this message and that it encourages you in your spiritual growth.
A warm welcome, an enthusiastic welcome. This is a little on the low side. Let's see. Everything's a little on the low side for me. All right. That is teetering on the brink of disaster right there. That's what that's doing. That's good. That's where I live. I have three kids, 15, 13, and 11. Teetering on the brink of disaster is my default position. What a great joy it is to be with you all today, and so excited to see so many, seemingly, at least from the worship service, it seemed like it, eager voices and eager faces. And I do want to spend some time allowing, what I was set to do is set the stage for questions and then allowing you to have your voice heard through the form of questions. I love that part of what I get to do is to hear from you, hear the toughest, the deepest, the most insightful and impactful questions on your mind, and wrestle with the material together and see if we can come to some mutual answers. So I'm looking forward to that part. So I'm going to give some a few introductory remarks and then hopefully get into the meat of our time together. I think 9:15 is when we're supposed to be done, and that's about 45 minutes from now. But the Q&A is my favorite part, so I'd like to see how much of that we can get accomplished. But this question, is faith wishful thinking? It's the common trope, you know, we think about these matters of faith all the time as faith is an idea. Faith is something where, you know, it's something you wish was true, but have no real idea if it's true or not. So you have faith in things sort of based on no evidence whatsoever, or maybe even in the face of strong contrary evidence. So people often think of faith as this blind leap, and it reminds me of a story. There's this guy who's walking down the street in a downtown area, and he goes by a travel agency. And in the sign, there's this sign that says, in the window, it says, River Cruise, all expenses, $100. He's like, $100 for all expenses River Cruise? That's crazy. So he walks into the travel agency, and the guy's at the counter, and he says, is that sign accurate, $100? Did you not miss a zero or something? It's $100 for a full expenses paid River Cruise? He goes, yep, $100, man. So the guy takes out a crisp $100 bill out of his wallet, puts it on the counter, slides it over, and says, sign me up. And that's when, bonk, he gets hit over the head with a club. Knocked unconscious. He wakes up, rubbing his head, to find himself bobbing down the river in a barrel. And he looks over at this other guy. And this other guy's in a barrel too. And he's rubbing his head. He says to the guy, hey, do they serve lunch on this cruise? And the other guy said, they didn't last time. People often think that people who have faith are like the second guy. You've done it before. The evidence was against this idea of it being a real cruise, and yet like a sucker, you went into it again. And faith is like just suckering you in. You keep on believing that God exists, that God loves you, but there's so much evidence against it, or there's no evidence in its favor. That's kind of, I think, how the caricature of faith actually works. So much so that Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, where he calls faith a delusion, he says this, a delusion is a persistent false belief held in the face of strong contradictory evidence, especially as a symptom of a psychiatric disorder. God is a delusion and a pernicious delusion. When one person suffers from a delusion, it is called insanity. When many people suffer from it, it's called religion. That's a harsh statement. Is that really what faith is all about? Is that really what it's all about? You see, this is a misunderstanding of the very idea of faith all by itself. And sadly, I will tell you this, many Christians are the propagators of the misinformation about what faith is. There's Christians who misinterpret the idea of faith. We often think it's just take a blind leap and trust when there's no evidence in its favor. But that's not what the Bible actually teaches. You will not find a statement in the Bible where it says, trust God blindly. It's not there. Go look. Rather, when you see in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, the definition of faith is actually there, that faith is the conviction of things hoped for. It's the substance of things not seen. Faith is the conviction of things hoped for. It's the substance of things not seen. In other words, faith and hope aren't the same thing. Do you see that? From the very sentence, it says, faith is the conviction of things hoped for. Now, if faith and hope were the same thing, that sentence would make no sense. It would be like, faith is the conviction of things faithed for. Or hope is the conviction of things hoped for. It's nonsense. But faith and hope aren't the same thing. They're actually distinct. Faith and hope aren't the same thing because hope is the positive expectation that something good will occur. Hope is the positive expectation that something good will occur. Faith is trusting in the one who said it will occur. Faith is trusting in the one who said it will occur. And everybody trusts something. I travel a lot for my job. I travel between 165 to 200 days a year, all over the world, to do these kinds of events in universities all across the world and in different venues and different forums. And I am married to an amazing woman, an amazing woman. I have no idea what she's doing right now. I don't. I have a hope that she's at home with our kids, that they're not sitting there by themselves wondering how am I going to eat, whatever it might be, or that she's not doing something that maybe is violating a sacred trust I've given to her. But I don't know that. I don't have knowledge that she isn't doing that. What I do have is faith in her. Why do I have the faith that my wife is doing the right thing, that she's actually being faithful to her vows to me? Why do I have that faith? Not because I have 100% knowledge, but I have enough knowledge based on what she's done in the past, based on the trustworthiness with which she's demonstrated herself, the fact that she has always been a trustworthy person in little and in much. I have trust based on evidence. And in the Bible, you won't see any place where it actually says, trust God with no good reason. Whenever God asks the Israelites to trust him in the Old Testament, it was based on something he did. It was on his miracles in delivering them from Egypt. It was on the various miracles and the various things he's provided for them, whether it was food in the desert when they had no food or water in the desert when they had no water. He had provided them for something, and then he says, trust me in this in the future. Even in the New Testament, you see this. Now, someone might say, wait a minute, hold on. Didn't Jesus say to Thomas, you believe because you see, but blessed are those who believe and do not see? Doesn't that suggest blind faith? Isn't that what faith is really all about? The answer is no. What's the story all about with Thomas? Jesus dies on a cross. Thomas did not expect that. Thomas was a guy who followed Jesus for 3 years. He was hoping that Jesus would be the deliverer of the people of Israel out of the hands of the oppressive Romans. That's what Thomas was hoping for. And then Jesus dies at the hands of the Romans. It's an utter shock and disappointment. And then something miraculous happens. There's reports creeping up that Jesus didn't stay dead, that the tomb he was in was known, and that the tomb he was in was empty 3 days later. And the men and women that Thomas was working with for 3 years and going around in the area of Galilee and in Judea, those people were saying, I saw him with my own eyes after his death, alive. I saw the risen Lord. And Thomas won't believe it. He says, I won't believe it until I see and feel the scars in his body. And what does Jesus do? He walks into the room and then he says, peace be unto you, Thomas. Look at the scars. I've done this for you. I've paid the debt that you owe to God. This is your peace. Stop doubting. And then Thomas falls to his knees and says, my Lord and my God. And then Jesus says to him, you believe because you see. Blessed are those who believe without seeing. Now, Jesus is not commending blind faith. Jesus is pointing something out to Thomas and to you and to me. Thomas had eyewitness testimony of people he trusted who said, multiple eyewitnesses who said, I saw the risen Lord. That is evidence. It's not him seeing it with his own eyes, but it is testimony. And I can tell you, I was a trial lawyer for 16 years, and we lock people up on eyewitness testimony because the jury wasn't there to see the crime happen, or the jury wasn't there to see the thing that the companies sued each other over. They weren't there. They have to rely on eyewitness testimony, and we don't always have a camera. So eyewitness testimony is good evidence, and Thomas had good evidence, and Jesus said, why didn't you believe based on the testimony of your brothers and sisters? You had good reason. And there will be those who do believe because of their testimony. See, Jesus wasn't saying that seeing is the only way to believe. He was saying seeing is one kind of way to believe. Everyone has to trust something. Even if you have no religious faith, you have faith in something. Everyone in this room, except for me, is sitting down. Some of you, one or two of you, are standing up. But everyone who's sitting down, did you test the chair with a weight before you sat in it? Did you say, you know what, I'm going to drop this weight like they do in manufacturing plants. Drop the weight, pick it back up, drop the weight. Yep, this can hold my bulk. Did you do that? You didn't do that. You sat in faith the chair would hold you up. You believed on faith that the chair would hold you up. Now, did you have good evidence to believe the chair would hold you up? Of course you did, because maybe you've sat in this chair before, or maybe you sat in a chair like this, and you know chairs like this tend not to fail. And maybe a much bigger guy sat in a chair. Maybe you saw me sit in the chair. You're like, if it can hold that guy up, it can definitely hold me up. But you don't know that. You don't have infinite knowledge or absolute certainty. You have to have faith, because if the laws of physics apply, these chairs are decaying even as we speak, and they're going to fail one day. Maybe when you sit in it, but you have faith. If you got here in a car, you already know this. If you got here in a car or you did anything in a car today, you didn't test the brakes to make sure they would work. But you had enough evidence, not complete evidence, but enough evidence to know that they wouldn't suddenly fail and you'd die in a fiery car wreck. Why would you do that? My goodness, you trusted those brakes with your life? You didn't test them? What, are you irrational? Are you crazy? No, of course not, because you had enough faith. You had enough evidence to justify your trust. What I want to suggest to you tonight, I'm going to go through it very briefly, is that we have enough good reasons to trust that God exists and that he cares about us based on the evidence, even though it's not 100% certain, and none of us is going to have 100% certainty about the issues, is that we have enough reason to believe in God to put our faith, our trust in him. In fact, that's what the Greek word in the New Testament that means faith, that word P-I-S-T-I-S, pistis, it means active trust. So now the question isn't, do you have faith? My question for you is, what is your faith in? Everyone has faith. The question is, what is the object of that faith, and is it worthy of the faith you put it in? Because all of us are going to die one day. The death toll is still one per person, except for this one guy. It's still one per person. And so you're going to have to face either oblivion or eternity. And the question is, do you have enough faith to make a good conclusion about which one it's going to be, oblivion or eternity, and what side of eternity it will be? I want to show you a couple of things why I think faith in God is not wishful thinking. The first reason I think faith in God is not wishful thinking is that God's existence makes sense of human rationality and the endeavor of science. God's existence makes sense of human rationality and the endeavor of science. You know, the objection that belief in God is a delusion assumes something. It makes the assumption that human beings are rational. And this is often a common objection, is that it's not rational to believe in a God you can't hear, can't see, can't touch, can't smell, none of these things. It's irrational to believe in a God like that. We have no empirical evidence. We actually do have empirical evidence of it, but they say it's irrational. There's an assumption. The assumption is human beings are rational in the first place. But here's the problem. If there is no God, there's only so many limitations and so many possibilities as to what you and I actually are. If there is no designer, no creator, no divine mind that infuses in you rationality, then this is what you are. You're either a complex chemical machine that simply responds to external stimuli, as Sam Harris, the atheist, would say, all you are is a chemical machine made up of a neural network that responds to external stimuli, so you don't actually have free will. In fact, in his book, Free Will, he argues you have none. Which is weird, because my question is, did you choose to write that book? But he's not wrong. If there's no God, then you are a chemical machine, and so am I. And so you don't come to rational conclusions. You don't. You don't look at the evidence and weigh it and then draw logical inferences from that evidence. All you do is respond to external stimuli based on your wiring. So if I believe in God, it's because my wiring requires I believe in God. And if you disbelieve in God, it's because your wiring requires that you disbelieve in God. And it doesn't matter if it's true or not, it's just the way you're wired. So you don't actually engage in rationalism or any rationalistic thought, which means you can't even do science. Because science is the gathering of evidence, weighing it against your hypotheses, drawing reasonable inferences from the evidence, and then making conclusions, and then adjusting your hypotheses accordingly. If you're a chemical machine, you don't do that. It's literally impossible. Nor can you do that if you're just, as one atheist calls us, exceptionally gifted chimps. Chimps don't do that. Gifted chimps don't do that. In fact, gifted chimps don't love. We don't long for relationship. We don't form attachments and romance and find meaning and purpose in things. All we do is band together like troops of other animals, of like herd animals. But is that really what you think about what you are and what your friends are and your family is? You know, it was Francis Crick. You know, James Watson and Francis Crick are the co-discoverers of the structure of DNA. Brilliant men. Nobel Prize winning men. And Francis Crick was talking about this when he says, with stark honesty about what you and I are, if there is no God, this is what he said. You, your joys and sorrows, your memories and your ambition, your sense of personal identity and free will are, in fact, no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Do you think of yourself that way? When you got up this morning to go to class or do whatever it was you were going to do today, did you look in the mirror and say, I'm a reasonably dressed, I look okay, collection and assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules? I am a sharply dressed nerve cell accumulation. Did you ever look into a baby's eyes, a newborn baby's eyes, and hold a baby, you know, a baby who's so chubby that the eyes are just decoration, and you think to yourself, what a cute assembly of nerve cells and associated molecules this is. Is that really what you think of yourself? And it's not an illusion. There's something inside of you that recognizes there's more to you than that. And the very fact that you have rationality in the first place proves it. I mean, let's put it this way. A lot of you use laptops and computers or whatever kind of devices you use for your schoolwork and for your studies. Now, let me ask you a question. If your laptop was put together by mindless, blind, indifferent forces that didn't have a design in mind, would you trust it? If your brain was made the same way, why do you trust that? Or do you trust that machine because you know that a bright mind was behind it? Why would you trust this unless a brighter mind than yours was behind this one? The very thought of rationality screams out for a creator and makes faith not wishful thinking, but actually more and more reasonable. And thus we see the popular idea that science actually disproves God, but the reality is science only is possible if a God who infused you with rationality actually exists. The very idea of science doesn't work without that. You know, it's interesting because people think that science will eventually squeeze God out of the picture, that science is a mechanism by which the balloon of our knowledge blows up and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And like a room in which that houses the balloon, as the balloon gets bigger and bigger, the empty space is faith. And as there's less and less empty space, there's less and less room for faith because we know more and more and more and more. And that's just simply not the case, because as we learn more about the world, about the universe, about the way things work, our faith is not squeezed out. Our faith is strengthened because we learn more about the one in whom we place our faith. People often say that religion is a science stopper. It'll stop the endeavor of science. You know, I was doing an open forum at a university. A friend of mine was actually giving the talk, and I joined him for Q&A. And he was talking about how science and faith are totally compatible. And he was rattling off all these names of the wonderful scientists that we owe so much of our advancements to, like Gregor Mendel, like Isaac Newton, like Galileo, and all the people, all of whom believed in God and actually pursued science because of their belief in God. And a young man gets up to the microphone and says, you know, my problem with the faith is this, is faith is a science stopper because it plugs God into the gaps of our knowledge. We don't figure out how things work. We say God did it, and we plug that into our gap of our knowledge, and that settles it for us. Interestingly enough, I don't know one Christian who thinks that way. Maybe there are Christians who think that way. I don't know who they are. But they certainly don't attend the universities I've ever attended. So do you know what's interesting about that? Is you're saying that faith is a science discourager. But then I read Proverbs chapter 25, verse 2. And this is what it says. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter. It is the glory of kings to seek things out. It is the glory of God to conceal something, not because he doesn't want you to discover it. God's glory is that he conceals things so that you will discover it. You know, my son, I have three wonderful kids, as I was saying before, and when my son was really young, he showed an affinity for letters and numbers. He loved all things letters and numbers. So like a good and overzealous first-time parent, I bought every conceivable toy with letters and numbers on it. So I bought my son this thing. It's a laptop, but it's not really a laptop. It's like a speak and spell that looks like a Spider-Man laptop to fool the kid into thinking he's got a computer. So he's sitting there at the table. I'm sitting next to him. My wife and I are talking, and suddenly my son says, "Fat." He says, "Fat." And he sounds it out. I'm like, what happened? I look at the screen, and there it is, the letters, F-A-T. He read the words. He read the letters, F-A-T, and read the word fat. I'm like, my son's a genius. He can read. Oh, my goodness. So I hit the next word button, and there it is, cat. And he sounds out the word cat. And then I'm like, what other words? So I hit in the words, and cat, rat, bat, all these things. He's reading. He is squealing in delight because of the discovery he's making. He is just over the moon with delight. I can guarantee you, of the two of us, I was more delighted than he was. But here's my point. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter because he delights when men and kings and women and queens seek things out. He encourages you to look at the world he created. That's why the brightest minds in modern history have been people of faith who don't want to say, how can I get God out of a job? I want to find out, how did God perform that job? Of an act of worship for many of them. So one, I think that faith is not wishful thinking, rather faith in God actually makes sense of our rational minds and the pursuit of science. Two, that science actually points to a physical world where we can see what Peter Berger called the signals of transcendence. There are little signals in the physical world that show us that maybe this whole thing was actually created. When you look at the way our solar system is constructed and the universe itself is constructed, there are things that are called just so or fine-tuning properties that allow for life to exist on this planet. For example, our planet is in what's called the Goldilocks zone. It's exactly as far as it needs to be away from a sun that is exactly the kind of sun that we need to have for life to exist. We're not too close, so we're too hot. We're not too far, so we're too cold. And the reason we're exactly in the Goldilocks zone is because the planets in our solar system are exactly the size and exactly the distance they need to be from the sun and from us to put us exactly where we need to be. And we have a gas giant, Jupiter, the gas giant, which pulls us away from the sun, but isn't so strong that it pulls us too far. But that gas giant is strong enough to suck in cosmic debris like asteroids and meteorites and all these things to keep us from getting pulverized by that debris. And so God has put in to this solar system just the right amount of mechanisms, just the right amount of liquid water in this world, just the right amount of hydrogen in our atmosphere and nitrogen in our atmosphere so that life can exist. To quote, I think it was Frederick Hoyle, it looks like someone's been monkeying with the physics. And we see that in the physical world, and then we see it all around us as well. There's a study of engineering called biomimetics. Maybe you've heard of this. If you're an engineer, maybe, and you're studying engineering, maybe you've heard of this idea. Biomimetics is the study of life to solve engineering problems. So if we want to solve aviation issues or we want to solve some kind of avionics, we look at the way birds take flight or the way bees actually fly, given their wing structures and the ways in which their wings move. If we want to find out how things move through liquids, we actually look at single-celled animals like paramecium, and we look to see how the flagellum motor, the motor that's inside the single-celled animal, moves the little flagellum that's behind it. And it's so complex, this little microscopic motor. Our finest minds, the brightest engineering minds in the world, look to nature to solve our engineering problems. So here's my question. If the finest engineering minds in the world need to look to a mindless accident for engineering, maybe we should rethink whether or not that accident was actually mindless. Maybe there was a brighter mind than all of our minds behind the engineering. You know, the Bible actually speaks to this. It's interesting because the Word of God is denigrated as this outdated, outmoded book, yet it also speaks decades, centuries, millennia ahead of our modern sciences. Biomimetics looks at nature to teach us how to do engineering. And Job chapter 12, verses 7 and 9 says this, "But ask the beasts, and they will teach you, the birds of the heavens, and they will tell you, or the bushes of the earth, and they will teach you, and the fishes of the sea will declare to you, who among all these does not know that the hands of the Lord has done this?" Powerful prediction, I think, of what we're seeing now. Then we look at each one of us, not just life on this planet, but each one of us. And I'll bring this to a rapid close so we can get to your questions. I'm from Michigan, so I have a lot of sweaters. It's cold. But I have this little sweater in my home that's useless to me, yet is the most valuable thing in my home. It won't even fit on this right hand. That's why it's useless. It's this small. This little purple sweater. My mother knit that sweater when she was pregnant with me. She was bringing me home from the hospital in that sweater after I was born. I brought home all my kids from the hospital in that same sweater after they were born. Now, when I describe that to you, and you think of my mother sitting there with her swollen belly, taking the design, the template for the sweater, and doing the cross, loop, whatever you do when you knit, when she was doing that, you see intimacy there, don't you? Yes, you see the design. Yes, you see a plan and a blueprint, and that's cold and unfeeling, but the knitting, that's not. Because when she was doing all that stuff, she was thinking, my son, my boy, Abdu. That's what she was thinking. The Bible doesn't say you were constructed. It doesn't say you were designed. It says in Psalm 139, you were knit together in your mother's womb. You praise him because you were fearfully and wonderfully made. Intimacy. God is an engineer, but he's an artist, and he's also a caring parent. So we look to rationality for signals of God. We look to science to show that God actually made choices in this world. And then we look to the cross for morality. You know, if there is no God above us, then we are the deciders of what's moral. We're the ones who decide what's moral. I don't know if you've checked lately, but we're terrible at this. We're terrible at it. I want you to think of the recent history. Ask any human being who's been on the sharp end of racism, or ask any human being who's been on the sharp end of sexism or misogyny, just how good human beings are at deciding what's right. This world is careening out of moral control. You know why? Because we decided to take the moral wheel and decide that we know what's right and what's wrong. And if you look at the history of this country, as great a country as this is, we have some check marks in our ledger. We really do. It was once legal in this country to own people as property. Even though most people thought it was okay, it wasn't. Here's what I'm saying to you, is that morality cannot be based on human opinion, because human opinion dictates atrocities. And if there's an objective moral standard, if it was objectively wrong to own people as property, if it was objectively wrong to commit the Holocaust, even if everyone thought it was okay, it was still wrong. That has to be rooted in a transcendent source, a source above us, because human opinion can't be the source. It's got to be someone above us. And morality attaches to people, to persons. And so transcendent morality must attach to a transcendent person. Who does that sound like? That sounds like God. And then we have the cross. The cross is the ultimate statement that you and me make moral choices that matter into heaven and matter into eternity. You see, if there is no God, then Mother Teresa, who gave her life in service to the children of India, gets the same exact reward as Adolf Hitler, who killed millions of people in service to himself. They both got oblivion. And that seems patently wrong. The cross is where God says, you were made in his image, yet you transcended the bounds. You walked away, and I walked away. And because we walked away and rebelled against God, we owe him a debt. And that debt is separation from him. But we can't pay that debt and live. Who can pay it for us? Only someone who has no debts of his own to pay can pay it for you and for me. That's what Jesus does. God incarnate, down to earth, living a perfect life that you and I could never live, so he could die a death that you and I deserve to die, but can't afford to pay. And so he dies, pays your debt, and then he rises from the dead as a matter of history, not hope, but history. I've debated many people about this, and you can look up my debates on YouTube, about the tremendous evidence there is for the resurrection of Jesus. And he dies and rises to show you that you have value. You see, if there is no God, then you and I are just the flotsam and jetsam of the universe. We are a vast assembly of nerves and associated molecules. And does that have any real value? Or does a being like you and me, who's made in God's image, have an infinite value? Here's the story I'll tell you and then I'll be done. A good friend of mine, who's an atheist, had dinner with me. And he said, you know, I'm having a hard time believing that God exists, given all the suffering in the world. I really have a hard time with this. We went around and around for a while, and we centered on this answer. There's a lot of answers to this, but this is the answer we centered on. I said, you know, if God exists, if he knows all things, future, past, present, all this stuff, he could allow suffering to exist. He won't cause it, but he could allow suffering for a greater possible purpose. It's at least possible, isn't it? And he said, yeah, it's possible that God could allow suffering for a greater possible purpose, you know, 50,000 years from now or whatever. Who knows? He says, but here's what I want to know. How could I know that this God is good and values me or my mother when he let her die when I was 10? You see, all this philosophical rubber has to meet the existential road at some point, friends. All these things I'm telling you have to become personal at some point. And so what do you do at that moment? Here's what I told my friend. I swallowed hard, I prayed quick, and this is what came out. I said, you know, you agreed that God could allow suffering for a greater possible good. He said, yeah, it's possible. I said, I don't know why he let your mom die. I don't. I have no idea. And I wouldn't pretend to tell you I know the answer. And I don't pretend to know I know the pain you're experiencing because I've lost people, but never someone so close at such a tender age. But 28 years he's been living with that because he was 38 years old when he asked me that question. And I could see from the look in his eyes, his atheism had not given him a good answer to his mother's death because Dawkins would say it's meaningless. And my friend couldn't live with that. And so I said this to him, it's not meaningless. You ask me, how do I know God is good and values you or your mother? Here's what I would tell you. How do you know how valuable anything is? How do you know how valuable anything is? You know how valuable something is by what you're willing to pay for it. And you can know, as a matter of actual evidence, that you and your mother have an infinite value because the immeasurable God paid an infinite price to spend eternity with both of you. That's fact. That's not theory. And God did allow suffering for a greater possible good. It's not a theory. God allowed his own son to experience unspeakable suffering for the greatest good that could ever be, the salvation of the world. He offers that to you, I said, and he offered that to your mother. He looked at me and he said, it's a lot to think about, but man, that's worth believing. So I want to offer this to you, that faith isn't wishful thinking. Faith is a force of will in believing in something because you have good reason to believe in it and trusting in the one who did so much for you and for me, from giving you the rational and brilliant minds you have at this university, from giving you the sciences by which we can actually see his fingerprints all over the world, and by giving you the inherent value each one of you has and proves it through his payment for you and for me. You can see him everywhere. Joseph Plunkett, the poet, knew this. And he said, I see his blood upon the rose, and in the stars, the glory of his eyes. His body gleams amidst eternal snows. His tears fall from the skies. I see his face in the flowers. The thunder and the singing of the birds are but his voice, and carven by his power, rocks are his written words. All pathways by his path, by his feet are worn. His strong heart stirs the ever-beating seas. His crown of thorns is twined with every thorn. His cross is every tree. There's signals of the transcendent all around you to give you enough reason to have faith in someone who doesn't abandon you to mere wishful thinking. Thank you, guys. We'll take questions. God bless you.
That is tall. Well, thank you, Abdu, for a wonderful talk. And I was sitting there listening to, by the way, we're going to open up Q&A, so there are going to be microphones on either side, so I don't know where they're at exactly now, but if you can go ahead and position those mics. I have a question to get us started as the students think of questions, but as you were sharing, you moved from speaking about why you think that faith is more than wishful thinking.
Yep.
To a very specific belief in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I'm very aware that you personally weren't born into a faith of trusting in Jesus.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious if you could share, as we kick off the Q&A, if what it was that caused you to consider Jesus in particular.
Yeah.
And maybe even what it was that convinced you that he indeed was the source of ultimate truth in life?
Yeah, great question. Let me just say, you might know this, you might not know this. I was raised as a Muslim. Maybe my name gave it away. People are like, well, yeah, but Abdu and Murray, what the heck? And the answer is that when we came over from the Middle East, I think this is the story I've heard. I wasn't, you know, cognizant of this at the time it happened. But when we came over, they said, what's your last name? We said, Murray. And they said, okay, Murray. So now I'm Scottish, apparently. But I was raised as a Muslim, and I didn't really want to believe that Jesus was who he said he was. See, Muslims believe that Jesus existed, that he was a prophet, he was a sinless man, he was born of a virgin and all this stuff, and he performed miracles, but he was not God. And he certainly didn't die on a cross. And so I didn't want to believe this idea, and I was growing up in an area of Detroit that the area I grew up in was not very diverse at the time. The city of Detroit is very diverse, but the suburb I grew up in was not very diverse at that time at all. There was like a couple of Indian families, a couple of Arab families, maybe one or two African-American families, but basically my family was the dollop of olive oil in the pot of rice. So we were exotic, and so I would engage with Christians about why they were Christians, and I'd ask them a question, why are you Christian? And most people gave me no good reason at all. They would just say, I don't know, we go to church on Christmas and Easter, so I guess I'm a Christian. I'm like, that's not a good enough reason. Have you thought it through? And the answer was no, they hadn't. It's like, well, I thought it through for you. And here's 15 reasons why you're wrong. A funny thing happened on the way to the mosque, as it were. And people who knew what they were talking about actually encountered me and responded to my objections and gave me strong evidence to believe that maybe this is actually true, that Jesus might be who he said he was. And I was very uncomfortable by this because that could mean a whole lot of change for me, including and especially my identity. See, I was very proud of being the Muslim that I was, and I didn't want to change my worldview. Yet, the evidence began to mount and was compelling. Now, what really got me there was this. The evidence for the Bible being transmitted down through the centuries faithfully was there, which is important because Muslims deny that the Bible is the intact word of God. They believe it was once God's word, parts of it were, and became changed over time, and that's why the Quran, the holy book of the Muslims, was revealed. But I could see the evidence mounting that the Bible we have now is what they wrote then. So that wasn't open to me to dispute anymore. But then I saw some beauty in this whole thing. You see, you've heard this phrase, Allahu Akbar. You've all heard this phrase, right? And you usually hear it on the news, and when you hear it, unfortunately, bad things usually occur afterwards. The reason why that's unfortunate is because most Muslims are not trying to murder you. They're really not. They're here to live the American dream. They want to get a good job, find the girl of their dreams, have kids who are good and raised well and go to good schools, and then have those kids find the girls or boys of their dreams, have those kids have kids, and then die happy grandparents. Does that sound familiar? That's what most Muslims want. But they say Allahu Akbar as a prayer and a praise. It literally means God is greater. So for the Muslim, the central idea of Islam is that God is great. And I used to think that Christians wished that was true, but couldn't justify it in their beliefs. Because how could a God who's great die on a cross? That seems absurd. But what ended up happening was, as the evidence was mounting in favor of the resurrection, in favor of the Bible's validity and all these things, what I saw wasn't just the factual evidence that spoke to my mind, but the existential evidence that gave meaning to the longings of my heart. And the meanings to the longing of my heart was this. I wanted to believe in a God who was infinitely great. Allahu Akbar, God is the greatest possible being. I wanted to believe in that. And then I saw what the cross was really all about. The cross is the sacrifice that God makes on the cross to pay the debt you and I can't pay. Now, if God is the greatest possible being, because Allahu Akbar is the idea that God is the greatest possible being. If God is the greatest possible being, then he would express the greatest possible ethic. What is the greatest possible ethic? It's love. And he would express the greatest possible ethic in the greatest possible way. What's the greatest possible way to express love? Self-sacrifice. So if God is unable to express love that way, then he's not the greatest possible being. That has to be so. The cross is where you see God expressing the greatest possible ethic, which is love, in the greatest possible way, which is self-sacrifice. And that's when I knew that's the God that must exist. If there is a God, it must be him. And the evidence shows, as I just elucidated, God does exist. And that's when I gave my life to him, because he fulfilled not only my intellectual longings, but the longings of my heart as well. You can't have a worldview that just speaks to your mind. It's got to speak to both. Because none of you are just Mr. Spock. And none of you are big crying babies. You're both. And so am I. Okay, let's go to the first question. How about you? You stood first up first, sir.
Hello.
Hi.
So I had a question about a specific set of two verses that I had trouble with.
Verses in the Bible?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was Exodus chapter 21, verses 20 to 21.
Okay, let me pull it up. Okay.
Okay. I can read it for you. I have it right here.
I would have context too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's Exodus. Give me a second, guys. Pardon me. Exodus chapter 20, right?
21.
Chapter 21, verses
20 through 21.
20 through something. All right, hit me.
The gist of this is it's basically talking about the punishment for beating a slave.
Right.
And it's talking about how if you beat a slave and it dies, you have to face the punishment of killing someone. Mm-hmm. But if you beat a slave and they recover from their wounds, you face no punishment because they are your property. And I wanted to know what, like, how is that moral?
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
I don't think that's moral. So I'm trying to figure out how.
Because
you talked a little bit about how when we've taken the wheel of morality that, you know, we've done bad things like this, but this is in the Bible. So I wanted to know. I wanted to know what you think about it.
That's a great question. How about the next one? I'm kidding. That's a great question. Well, that is an excellent question. Thank you very much. What's your name?
Carter.
Carter. Thank you for the question, Carter. So Carter. All right. Carter's got a fan base. So Carter, here's what I would say. First, we have to look at the baseline. What you've asked is a moral question, right? It's basically saying, how could this be moral? If God is the center of all morality, how could this be moral? Let's say for a moment it's not moral. Let's just say that. I think that when I explain it, hopefully you'll see that it's not what you think it is. But let's say it's not moral. But if there's no God, then the question itself assumes subjective morality, because God is the source of objective morality. So if there is no God, then the question isn't really objectively moral, it's just subjectively moral, because it's all up to human opinion. So you might not think it's moral, but they did. And who are you to tell them they're wrong? Because if there's no transcendent authority above us, then you're just relying on the world according to Carter, and they're relying on the world according to, you know, Jehoshaphat. I don't know, you know what I'm saying? So your word and their word, all that is competing human beings telling who's right and who's wrong. And they'll change their opinions and you'll change your opinions. So the question itself, as a moral question, already assumes God exists. Now the force of your question is still strong, because it's saying, but this can't be the God who exists, because this is immoral, right? Okay, so now we have to understand the verse, not only in its context, but the words as they're used in the Hebrew. So my name is Abdu. Now Arabic and Hebrew are both Semitic languages. In fact, Arabic is a derivative of Hebrew. So the word for servant, my name means his servant. That's what it means. When you see the word Abdullah, the name Abdullah, it means servant of God. Also can be translated as slave of God. So the word in Hebrew for slave or servant is Obed. See how similar they are? Obed, Abdu, that kind of thing. So what you have in the Bible is actually not a description of slavery. So when we think of slavery, and, you know, this is not an area insensitive to this issue, of course. We're very sensitive to this. When we think of the word slavery in modern times, what we're thinking is antebellum South slavery. That's one system of slavery. When you look at the Bible, it doesn't describe it that way at all. It's not talking about that the word is literally slave, but when you look at the context, and context often determines the import or the meaning of words, it actually is referring to indentured servitude. It's voluntary. So in antebellum Southern slavery with the slave trade, you had slave traders going from England, from America, from parts of Africa, from the Middle East and other places, going into a place, kidnapping people, and then selling them as cargo and taking them across the Atlantic as cargo against their will to a foreign country. That's not what this is. If you look even before this chapter, you'll see that what the slavery is all about, it's not really slavery, it's indentured servitude, where they actually voluntarily, because they owe a debt to somebody, they say, I will work in service to you without pay, but you'll have to feed me, by the way, without pay so I can pay off my debt. And when the debt is paid, you have to release me. And then, even if the debt is not paid, the Bible actually says, even if the debt is not paid, every 7 years, you have to let all of your indentured servants go. They have to be made free. If they choose not to be made free, then they can stay with you and work for you. But this is a voluntary system that is fundamentally different than slavery of the antebellum South. It's not even close to the same thing. It's not even close. So that's the first distinction I want to make for you. Then we look at this verse where if you kill an indentured servant, you have the penalty for death. But if you don't kill them, then you don't have to pay the penalty for death. Why? It's because of the economic arrangement of the indentured servitude, is that you don't have to pay the penalty of death because no one died. It's the lex talionis, you know, it's the idea that equal crime for equal punishment. What you've committed is a economic crime against this person, but you still owe the slave some damages at some point. And there's other parts of the Bible that discuss this. But the person who, quote unquote, owns the slave, who owns the debt the slave is working off, if they can't pay it off, you might owe that person money because you've impaired that person's ability to have the debt repaid, which, by the way, allows the slave to go free faster. So when we think of slavery in the Bible, it's very different, extremely different than what we think of today. It's not the same kind of thing at all. You see various ways in which the Bible speaks of these things. By the way, the Bible actually speaks of this too. I can't remember, I think it was in the book of Job, where Job says, when I speak to my family, or I speak to a countryman, or I speak to a servant or a slave, the same word, do I not also think of him as a brother? Is he not also equal to me? So that's important for us to understand as well, is that in the oldest book of the Bible, Job is the first book of the Bible written, actually. It's the oldest one written. He even says, the servant is equal to me. They're not less than me. And in the antebellum South, slaves were considered not even human, which is what the three-fifths compromise was all about. They're three-fifths of a person. In our quote-unquote enlightened face, after the Enlightenment, we still thought this way. Yet the Bible was saying, no, indentured servants are actually people who actually have a soul. And it's not based on race, by the way. This is no matter who enters into indentured servitude. So it's vastly different than the system of slavery. Let me end on this one last bit here, is that when you look at the New Testament now, okay, so the Roman system of slavery is very much like what we're talking about here in the antebellum South, but it's not based on race. Anybody can be a slave, but they were actually slaves. So Paul says in 1 Timothy, he says, slave trading is a sin. He calls it a sin specifically because it's different than Old Testament indentured servitude. And then he writes this letter. This is kind of cool. Give me a second, okay, on this one. This is an important question you're asking. He writes a letter, this little tiny letter, and what he's settling is a personal dispute. And you're like, well, why would this letter be included in the Bible? This thing where he just settles a dispute between people. It's called Philemon. And in this letter, he's talking to Philemon. He's saying, there's this guy who is a slave to you. His name is Onesimus, and he's a runaway slave. And he owes a debt to you. Now, I'm supposed to, under Roman law, return him to you, but I'm not going to. In fact, what I want you to do is charge his debt to me. Act as if I'm your slave. I would rather substitute myself for him than let him be a slave to you anymore. And by the way, Philemon, when you do this, not only will you free Onesimus of his legal obligation, you'll free yourself from your moral shackles. And then Philemon does it. He changes his heart on this. And then we see in another letter where Paul says, I'm sending Tychicus and thus and such to you, and Onesimus, the former slave, who is one of you. The former runaway slave comes back as an equal because of what Paul did. That's the Bible from beginning to end. It doesn't condone slavery. It might regulate an unsavory practice, but not condone it. And it actually says slaves are people who are set to be free. That's why the original slave owners of the antebellum South and the American and the British slave trade wouldn't teach the Bible to their slaves, because they said if they learned this, they'll learn that they're actually human people. And that's why Wilberforce used the Bible as his text to end the barbaric slave trade. It's an excellent question. I hope that helped out with your answer. Thank you very much, Carter. God bless you. Yes, sir.
Can you hear me?
Hi, yeah.
Hi, how's it going? I'm Silas.
Hi. Got a little closer, Silas, if you could?
Yeah, like closer?
Well, I mean like into the microphone.
Okay, my bad.
I'm asking you to dance, Silas. I just want to hear your voice.
Okay, so I know that I need God, But my question is, does God need me or does God need us? And if so, why or in what ways?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. That's a good one. So the answer to part A of your question is, do I need God? The answer is yes. First, you need God for existence. Second, you need God for fulfillment. See, you know, people always wonder, what's the meaning of life? What's the meaning of life? Oh my goodness, what's the meaning of life? And whenever you see it in TV or whatever, you always see this guy climbing up a mountain because for some reason high altitude is where answers are found. Or Forrest Gump running across the United States. For some reason, running long distances gets you the answers too. And they crawl up the mountain and they finally get to the top and their clothes are all tattered. They're covered in dirt. And there's this guy sitting there at the top of the mountain in front of the ashram. And he's got his feet crossed in a lotus position, and he's got eyebrows that won't quit. And he asks the guy the question. He says, oh, great teacher, what is the meaning of life? And as he opens his mouth, it cuts the commercial. Because we don't know the meaning of life. It's the hardest question in the world to answer. It's not really that hard. Sorry, that sounds arrogant, I know, but it really isn't that hard. It's pretty simple. The Westminster Shorter Confession tells us this. The chief end of humanity is to glorify God and delight in his presence forever. Your purpose and my purpose is relationship, not just with each other, but with the divine. That's the chief reason you and I were made. So this actually makes sense of something. I want you to think about this for a moment. If there was a blind, pitiless, indifferent universe that caused you, then that means you're the effect. Now, if the blind, pitiless, relationless universe causes you, what explains the reason why the cause produces an effect, which is you, that desires relationship and intimacy and meaning? You know, it can't be evolution, because I want you to think about this. Bees are very collective, very communal animals, but they don't love each other. Ants are collective, but they do it to keep the species from propagating. They want it to keep propagating. Baboons have troops for safety. I can tell you this right now, people don't get married for safety. They get married for intimacy, for connection, and for love's sake. That's not an evolutionary process. That's a divine process. And so here's what I would say to you. And this is uniquely a Christian thing, Silas. The Christian conception of God is that he is one in his nature and three in his persons. He's a Trinity. Other systems of belief would say that God is one. My former faith says that God is one. He is one in his nature and one in his person. He is undifferentiated. There is no division within God. That's what us Muslims believe. And others believe this as well, that God is just one and there's no differentiation. The Christian conception of the Trinity is that God is one in his nature. He's one what? With three whos. He has three minds, three consciousnesses that are each distinct and separate, yet they share the same nature. Is that hard to understand? You bet. But is it contradictory? No, because a nature and a personhood are not the same thing. So if you were saying God was one in one way and three in the same way, that's a contradiction. But if you're saying God is one in one way in what he is, and he's three in a different way in who he is, that's not a contradiction. So it doesn't defy our logic, but it does transcend our understanding. And here's what I would say. If you have a conception of God that is easy to understand, then your God is a little too small. Because can you imagine us finite beings who depend on a sun to give us warmth can understand the creator of that very sun? Like that? That's an insufficient view of God. So God is a triune being. He's one in his nature and three in his persons. Why is that important to your question? I think it answers both questions. Why we need God and does God need us? We need God because we are relational beings. And the fact that you and I are relational, we want, have, covet, mourn the loss of relationships. We are incurably relational. And a blind, pitiless, indifferent universe that doesn't have relationship as its course can't be the cause of you, the effect. But a being like God who defines relationship, the Father loving the Son loving the Spirit loving the Father and the Son, and on it goes in eternity in the community of the Trinity, that being who defines relationship can explain why you, as the effect, want relationship. Now, to your second question, does he need us? The answer is no, he does not. And here's why. He wasn't ever lonely. God exists in a community of a Trinity. He has perfection of relationship. The Father, Son, and Holy Spirit love each other perfectly, and they never lack relationship. God didn't create you and create me because he was bored or lonely. He had a divine dance from eternity in the Trinity. So why does he create you and me? Why does he create you and me? Not because he was lonely, but because out of the self-giving nature of his love, he creates you, not so that he can have relationship. He already has it. He creates you so that you can have relationship. It is an utterly selfless act. He gets nothing out of it except the joy of seeing you enjoy him. That's selflessness. That's a God worth believing. So we need him, he doesn't need us, and the Trinity makes that possible. Only in Christianity, I believe, does that idea that we need him and he doesn't need us make any kind of sense. I hope that helps, Silas. Thank you very much for your question.
Thank you.
Yep, you bet. How about you? A little closer if you could. I know that's a little awkward.
My name is Thomas. Nice to meet
you. Hi, Thomas.
Okay, so you mentioned how God must exist for free will to exist.
Yeah.
Okay, so my question is as follows. Why is it necessary to instill free will given that he created us?
Yeah.
That's the first part of that question.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part is, how can he guarantee that in the end, despite our free will, we all choose the right path of following him?
Okay, so let me take the first part first, because that's logical. Why is it necessary that he instills in us free will? The short answer to that, Thomas, is that it's not. He doesn't have to. He could create little robots. He's done that. They're called ants. And they're called monkeys. And they're called gazelles and plankton. They just respond. They're not really, they have free will in the sense that a spider could choose to go to eat this fly and not this fly, but it's based on instinct. They're not really choosing anything. They're just responding to stimuli. So he has done that, but it's not necessary he even creates us like that. But it would be necessary if you and I were to have relationship with him. Because relationship always requires free will. It always requires at some point in the relationship some modicum of free will. Because if I create a person, I have a wife, a wonderful wife. If I met her and I gave her some kind of a pill or something that made her love me, when she thought she loved me and she thought it was true affection, but it wasn't. It was totally manufactured, and I kept on feeding that to her for the 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, 36 years, 100 years of our marriage, however long we're going to live. That would be wrong. That would be wrong, and it wouldn't be genuine, because her love would only be fake, be manufactured. So if God creates you like a wind-up toy, where he does this and this and says, okay, clap the symbols together, love me, please. That wouldn't be love. That wouldn't be relationship. That would just be him playing with his toys. But in order for you to truly love him and for me to truly love him, he has to create in you the possibility that you will choose not him. There has to be the possibility that you will choose against him. Without that, love isn't real. Now, second part of your question, I'm a little bit forgetful on what it was, but I think it was essentially, why don't you repeat it? That way I'll get it.
So the second part of that question was, given that everyone has free will,
yep,
how is it possible for him to guarantee that in the end, everybody will choose God?
Yeah, and the answer is it's not. It's not possible for him to guarantee it. Because think about, so people think God is all powerful. God can do anything. And I agree with that. God is all powerful. He can do anything. That's reasonable. See, people misconceive the idea of God's omnipotence, that God can do literally anything. No, he can't. Can he make square circles? Can he make married bachelors? Can he lie? The answer is no to all three, because all three defy logic, because square circles, by definition, have no corners. By definition, squares have four. Bachelors, by definition, aren't married. And being married requires you to not be a bachelor. So he can't do the impossible. He can't do the logically silly. He can do the impossible. If he wanted to, he could lift all of you up off the chair right now and have you float there and defy gravity. But that's not logically impossible. It's just physically impossible. But logically impossible, he can't do it. Why? Because God is the source of all logic. And to be illogical would be to contradict himself. And he's not going to do that. And he can't make a world in which free creatures are forced to love him and make the right choice. Now, what he can do is he can set up circumstances because he knows what you would do under certain circumstances so that you would have the free ability to choose him or not him. But if he forces your hand and makes you choose him, then you didn't really choose at all. That's exactly the opposite of free will. So he can't guarantee that free creatures will always choose him, which is why, in this world, free creatures don't. I mean, there's plenty of people who have not chosen him, who have shaken their fists at the heavens. When Christopher Hitchens, the well-known atheist, died, his last written words were, "Don't keep the faith." I don't think he went to heaven, because he didn't want to. And I don't think God would have made him do that. He wouldn't force him to do that. However, here's the cool part about this, okay? Thomas, I want you to see this. God has what's called middle knowledge. Middle knowledge isn't just knowledge of what you will do. Middle knowledge is knowledge of what you would do under certain circumstances. So God can allow a world to exist where he sets up things optimally so that you will have all the evidence and all the good reasons you will need to have to make a rational choice to follow God. But he won't force your hand because he wants that true relationship with him. So he can set up things where you're given the optimal chance to make the right choice, but he's never going to force you to make the right choice. And people all the time reject evidence. They do it all the time. I'll give you an example. I had a friend. He was a partner of mine at my law firm. And whenever I talked about God, well, actually, he would bring it up. He was an atheist, which is interesting because no one talks about God more than those who don't believe in him. They do talk about him all the time. That's good. I want them to do that because it engages in the conversation. So Frank would come in. He'd make some snarky remark. But we were friends. He could do that, and it was like a good ribbing, you know? So he'd make a snarky remark. We'd engage in the conversation, and then he'd leave. I'm like, well, no. Frank, come back. Sit down. That was his name. So we sat down, and he said, there's just not good enough reasons to believe in God. There's not enough evidence. I said, what would qualify as evidence for you, Frank? He said, if there was a golden cross in the sky, and every morning a voice came from the golden cross and said, John 3:16, I would believe that. Like, that's a lot of evidence, but let me just tell you this. We have that much evidence and. But my guess is, even if you saw that, you wouldn't believe anyway. He's like, that's ridiculous. I'm like, really? Okay. So, do you smoke? And the answer was yes, he smokes. So let me ask you a question, Frank. When you started smoking, did you know it was addictive and could cause cancer and kill you? He said, yeah. I said, tell me again how evidence matters to you. You see, this is the thing I think all of us have to deal with. Every single person in the room. Everyone in the room. God has provided enough evidence. Pascal said it this way. God has provided enough evidence that faith in him is the most reasonable conclusion, but he has left enough evidence out that faith in him without trusting is impossible. So God does set up the world so that we can believe in him, but he doesn't force our hand because of our free will, and he wants us to enjoy true relationship with him. That's a great question, Thomas. Thank you so much for it.
Hi, my name is Alex.
You win points for the cool shirt.
Oh, thank you.
Or if you're a geek, it's cool, but if you're not, then it's a nerdy shirt, but that's okay.
I won't take offense to that.
Don't. I love that shirt.
Good. My name's Alex. My question is, how much can we trust what we read in the Bible, not because the words we're reading on the page could be wrong, but because our own interpretation could be fallible?
Well, we're always guilty of the possibility of misinterpreting things, aren't we? Mm-hmm. And we also inject things that aren't there because we don't have a careful reading of the Bible. So an example is when we think of the word a slave. Now, it's on face value. You see it, and you're like, well, the word slave is there. And so you're perfectly reasonable to read it and say, the Bible seems to condone slavery. Now, if you did the careful work of understanding what the word actually means in its context, then you would see maybe it's actually different than that. So our interpretation isn't faulty in that we're not intelligent enough to interpret it, so we haven't delved enough into the level of the words or the context of the meanings. So oftentimes, I think most misunderstandings of the Bible are not based on what the Bible says, but the way we interpret it incorrectly. And we often do this by simply reading one Bible verse. And let me just give you this advice from a friend of mine, Greg Kokel. Never read a Bible verse. Read the whole paragraph. Read the whole chapter. Read the book. read the whole Bible in the context and you'll find out what they mean. Reading one Bible verse can be dangerous because it becomes a proof text. And a proof text without context becomes a subtext for a pretext. But that's not mine. You can clap for that, but it's not mine. But that's what I think is the problem, is we don't read it in context. And so a lot of our interpretations come that way. All right. Can we take one more? Is that okay? Or are we running out of time? All right, you've been faithfully standing there the whole time. Haha, faithfully. So why don't you ask your question?
Oh, okay.
This is the last one, guys. I'm sorry.
I have two, if that's possible.
All right.
Oh, sweet, sweet, sweet. So when you talk about the necessity of a single entity to give objective moral truths,
yeah.
What room does that leave for other interpretations of religion?
It leaves a lot to begin with, because I haven't made a claim about any particular religion. What I've said is that there is a necessary being, that's God, to ground morality. Now, that might exclude polytheistic religions, like the Babylonians and the Greeks, which don't exist anymore, and so that's not really a problem for me anymore. I don't really care, because they don't exist. Their religions died out long ago because there was no evidence for Zeus or Artemis or whatever. And maybe you would say, well, how about the polytheistic religions of Hinduism? And they have 330 million gods, and doesn't that leave no room for there? Well, a Hindu would tell you that all those gods, the 330 million gods, are actually all incarnations of the one impersonal absolute force, which is Brahman. So it leaves room for Islam, it leaves room for Judaism, because both believe in a single entity, God, who actually justifies morality, Judaism and Islam. So it leaves room for Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. It might leave room for some forms of Hinduism. It doesn't leave a whole lot of room for Buddhism, because Buddhism is a non-theistic religion. It doesn't even ascribe to a god. It believes that we're an accretion of karma, and our goal is to realize our nothingness. So it doesn't even go there. Confucianism, Shintoism, all these other things don't really have that same level, so I think that it excludes them, actually. So that sounds harsh. Like, I'm using this rule to exclude people. But exclusion's not a bad thing. It really isn't. Because if we're weeding out that which is false, that's good. We're getting to the truth by deduction. And so if we have exclusions from other religious interpretations of reality, that's fine. Now, not every religion is 100% false all the time. I do think that there's only one way to God. I do think that. And I think it's substantiated in the evidence for the historic Christian faith, that God exists and he is existing in the person of Jesus, who did what he did and said what he said. That's in distinction to other religious systems. So it does, the moral argument leaves room for some kind of a God, but the question now is, how is that morality expressed? And if there's evidence for that expression of that morality in one specific way, then that excludes all other interpretations of religious expression. So I hope morality allows for God. Christian morality, which I think has evidence behind it, allows for only one interpretation of who that God is. Does that help?
Thank you.
Yep, great.
And then
number two.
The number two is, given our evidence for, like, our strong evidence for microevolution,
yeah,
and some evidence for macroevolution, where do you say when you talk about the, like, how monkeys are actually robotic machines versus humans being soul creatures that have been given by God? Where is that line drawn?
Like, sure.
It's hard to wrap your mind around sometimes.
That's a great question. So that would take a long time to answer, but I'm going to give you the short version, the very Cliff's Notes-y version of this. Two things I would recommend for your reading. Two books. One is both are by atheists, by the way, so that's going to surprise you. Book number one is called Aping Mankind by Raymond Tallis. It's about that fat, but it's funny. This guy is brilliant, and he's funny. And you'll like this. He's British, and everything he says is brilliant because he's British. He's a neuroscientist and an evolutionist. And he says, in Aping Mankind, that neither Darwinism nor neuroscience can explain human consciousness and morality above that of our closest genetic ancestors. He says it can't explain it. And they're the only game in town. So what's left to explain it? I'll spoil it for you. After 368 pages, he says, I don't know. I have a guess. I think it's God who infuses us with that. Second book is by a philosopher named, forgetting his name right now, out of New York University. Thomas Nagel. Couldn't remember his name. Thomas Nagel. He wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos, where he says that the neo-Darwinian materialistic explanation for human rationality is almost certainly wrong. That's a subtitle to his book. That's quite a subtitle. But the book is actually short, despite the title. And it's brilliant because he says that these things don't account for it. And he says there is no explanation that we can see naturalistically. We have to add something to it. He doesn't want it to be God because he's an atheist, but he's saying, you know what? They're not irrational for thinking it's God. So it could be, let me give you two possibilities, okay? We have two possibilities. God uses evolution to create human beings, and then at some point in the chain of evolution, he infuses Homo sapiens with wisdom. That's what sapiens actually means, you realize that, right? Homo sapiens is wise man. So he infuses them divinely with wisdom. That's a possibility. I think it's not really faithful to the biblical interpretation, but the Bible is not completely clear on how God created everything. It says that he created them, the sequence in which he created them. And then we look at the science to determine how he did it. So as a Christian, I'm open to the evidence. I'm open to whatever the evidence happens to be. But if I was a scientific naturalist or a methodological naturalist or a philosophical naturalist, I can only allow naturalistic explanations for things. And that makes me close-minded to the evidence. So it's ironic, isn't it, that as a Christian, I see what the Bible says, and I can be open to wherever the evidence leads. But now the question is, where does the evidence lead? Microevolution, which is basically variation within a species, that's fine. I mean, that's obvious. There's variation within the species right here. We see it right before our eyes. But what we don't see is any strong evidence for speciation, where one species stops existing, transitional forms happen, and then it completely changes into another species. The fossil record is really sort of silent on this. And what we see, like in Archaeopteryx and other things, are not intermediate forms. What we see, we don't see transitional forms, we see what's called an intermediate form. It's a form that looks a little bit like two different kinds of things, but it's not a stepping stone between a dinosaur and a bird, for example. It's not, we know that. So we don't see any evidence of transitional forms. Now, what Darwin suggested was, if it's true that the abundance of life that we see comes from transitions, slow change over time due to random mutations and natural selection, what we should see is more transitional forms in the fossil record than we see final forms in the fossil record. And we don't see any. That's a little bit of a problem. Now, I'm not casting aspersions at the theory. All I'm saying is I'm open to the evidence, and the evidence seems to be lacking. So for the time being, at least, I don't want to interpret the Bible in light of science because science is changing. I want to take a look at science and look at the evidence, weigh it for what it's worth, and say, what does the science say? What does the Bible say? And the Bible says, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings, yet crowned him with glory and honor. Because God, I think, did make us special and specific. And at that point, when he breathed into us of his life, I think that he made us in his image, specially and by divine power. Whether he did it over an evolutionary period of time or he did it right when he made Adam and Eve, I think that we're here. And that's evidence enough that you are not a chimp and you are not a chemical machine. None of you are. And your faith in a God who made you that way is not wishful thinking. That's all the time I have. Excellent question. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you for listening to the Chi Alpha at the University of Virginia podcast. For more information, you can visit our website, xaatuva.com.